Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Stephen Wells, the executive director of the Animal Legal Defense Fund, whose stated mission is to protect the lives and advance the interests of animals through the legal system. They do so by employing a variety of measures, including filing lawsuits to protect animals from harm, providing free legal assistance and training to prosecutors to assure that animal abusers are punished for their crimes, among other gambits. We'll hear more about the Animal Legal Defense Fund, its history, evolution, some of its recent campaigns, and more when I speak with Stephen Wells in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Wells is slated to participate, by the way, in a Careers in Animal Law panel this Friday at Stetson University College of Law. So I want to let you know that if you're listening this morning, you already do know that we've been sort of bedeviled by ghosts in the machine. So our broadcast signal has been dropping out periodically. And in this studio, we're without internet access, at least at the moment, so I unfortunately won't see your emails and texts. But rest assured, our stellar engineering and operations staff is working to correct both those problems, and we appreciate your patience in the meantime. Later in today's show, I'll speak with Don Goldstein of Greyhound Rescue Adoptions of Tampa Bay, or GREAT, about two new pieces of pending legislation that have important implications for greyhounds and those who care about them. In this era of specialization over the years, Don has become Talking Animals greyhound legislation expert, so I look forward to speaking with him again later in the show. Right now, though, let's get to Stephen and the Animal Legal Defense Fund with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, and again, if the moment at least, we don't have the option for emailing or texting, but I will let you know if that changed. So with that in mind, let's welcome Stephen Wells to Talking Animals. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thank you for having me, Duncan. I appreciate it.
You bet. So over the course of our chat, I expect, of course, we'll hit at least a remedial overview of the Animal Legal Defense Fund and some of the organization's recent campaigns and, of course, touch on this panel you'll be speaking on locally here on Friday and hopefully more even beyond that. But while you've been at ADLF for about 18 years, you traveled a pretty intriguing, sometimes colorful path before joining ALDF. So let's trace a bit of that path. For example, the Alaska years seem quite significant to the Steve Wells saga. What first drew you to Alaska?
Well, I grew up in Chicago, in the inner city, but I always had a love of the outdoors and wildlife. We would go on camping trips as a kid and so forth, and I was just always taken with that. And I have family roots in Western Canada, in British Columbia and so forth, and the mountains and the wide open spaces just always called to me. So at some point I hit my mid-20s and decided that I didn't want to spend the rest of my life in Chicago. So like a lot of other folks, I headed west. And for me, it was northwest.
Yeah.
Alaska.
I read somewhere that among your time in Alaska, you were involved in cleaning up the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah, the year that I headed to Alaska happened to be the same year that the Exxon Valdez oil tanker ran aground in Prince William Sound. And so it so happened when I got up there, I was horrified like the rest of the country was about the damage that was done. And I got work working on the spill cleanup. So I was sent out to Prince William Sound, and what I saw was just a nightmare. This incredibly beautiful, pristine area with just mountains running right to the sea and all kinds of, you know, wildlife on land and marine mammals and birds and just oil everywhere. You could, you know, the stench of it was overwhelming. Of course, there were dead animals that had been affected by the oil. And the impact for me, you know, I think growing up in the city and dreaming about the wide open spaces in places like Alaska, I really didn't understand that those places that seemed sort of sacrosanct or out of the reach of the modern life in a big city like Chicago, were really equally impacted by the activities of people everywhere, and that those places were vulnerable, especially if they were places, that had resource extraction, you know, like oil drilling and delivery. And it changed the course of my life. Prior to that, I had run a business in Chicago that I sold when I moved, and had every intention of pursuing a career in journalism, actually, continued that after I got to Alaska. But I realized that whatever my skill set was, that I had to become an advocate, and I had to work to protect the land and animals that I cared about. Because they were very vulnerable, and that was really where my career and life path shifted dramatically after that experience.
Well, we're going to delve into that in a moment, but I guess there's one or two more aspects of the Alaska years I'd like to discuss. One of those is the cabin you lived in your first year there. I was struck that it had no running water or electricity. So back then, were you just a particularly rugged wilderness guy or a troubled loner, or what was the story there?
Yeah. No, it was my desire to fully immerse myself in wilderness and the Alaskan experience. So it just so happened that on the oil spill, I met a guy who became friends with, who had a cabin out in the wilderness. And I was not alone, actually, for that entire experience. But decided that I wanted to spend winter in Alaska and do it the hard way. So I was in a cabin that didn't have running water nor electricity, and I had to haul supplies and fuel for the wood stove and all that kind of stuff. And it was quite an experience. I'm glad I did it. I'm not sure I would want to do that again, but when you love the wilderness, there's nothing quite like it. One experience I had was that as that experience came to an end and I was decided I needed to move back to the city and get on with school and work and all that kind of stuff, I had an interview for a job I was going to take, and I woke up in the cabin and there was a grizzly bear and her two cubs were playing just outside the cabin and right along the path that I had to walk to get to my car, which was a hike. So I just had to sit there and wait. And there weren't cell phones then. I had no phone line, so there was no way I could let my potential employer know. But funnily enough, when I finally got into town and made a call, he was quite understanding. He asked me about the bears and wanted to know about the whole experience. So then I knew I was in the right place for me at that
time. That's your kind of guy. Yeah, that's great. I guess that may be also partly Alaska folk, maybe a little more inclined that direction. So let me know, folks, know this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Stephen Wells, the executive director of the Animal Legal Defense Fund. He'll be in town Friday speaking on a careers in animal law panel at Stetson University College of Law. If you'd like to ask Steve a question or offer a comment, at the moment we're limited to phone calls at 813-239-9663. We don't have internet here in the studio. We're having a few little glitches at the station today, so I can't access the DJ email or text, but you're welcome to call. And again, if you are having trouble with our signal dropping out, it is totally fine streaming. So either if you have access to a computer or you have your phone and have the WMNF app open and running, you can still listen without interruption there. The last thing I want to touch on from the Alaska years, Steve, is kind of should serve as a nice transition, hopefully, into the Animal Legal Defense Fund, is your stint at the Alaska Wildlife Alliance. Maybe just give us a little nickel tour of the Alaska Wildlife Alliance. What was its main mission, and what do you look to as your proudest accomplishment while you were there?
Sure. As I mentioned, I wound up back in Anchorage and was going to school and keeping true to my promise that I was going to do advocacy work. I initially started volunteering for a couple of groups, including the Alaska Wildlife Alliance. And with my journalism background, I did a lot of writing for them and so forth. And that led to my first position in advocacy, a part-time position doing writing for their newsletter and so forth. But as it turned out, over time, that eventually became full-time. And the skills I'd learned having run a business, and I had actually started another small business in Anchorage, that was helping me pay for school, turned out to be valuable in the nonprofit world as well. And I was ultimately offered the position of executive director at the Alaska Wildlife Alliance. And that was my first taste of sort of melding my passion for, I love business and I loved running organizations, and of course, melding my passion for advocacy. And real quick, we worked on wildlife protection issues and habitat protection issues. So we did a lot of work on protecting parks and national wildlife refuges, fighting efforts. Oftentimes the state was pretty aggressive in trying to allow resource extraction in most places. And hunting is a huge pastime up there, of course. But the biggest campaigns were always around protection of wolves and bears. And the state had the attitude that wolves and bears were competitors for moose, caribou, and deer with hunters, and wanting to sell more hunting licenses and have more of the share of moose and caribou go to hunters over wild predators. The state had always designs on killing or allowing to be killed as many wolves and bears as possible. So that was the most aggressive fights I was involved in, and we had a really great success. 1 year where we worked on a ballot initiative in the state that banned same-day airborne hunting of wolves, which allowed people to fly around, spot wolves from the air, which is easy to do against snow in the wintertime, and then essentially land their plane next to wolves and shoot them. We were successful with that ballot initiative, which is a real shot across the bows in Alaska that people's attitudes were changing, and it wasn't just the state of hunters anymore. Sadly, a footnote to that is Congress just passed a bill that overturned protections the Fish and Wildlife Service had given wolves and bears on national wildlife refuges in Alaska, preventing things like killing pups in dens and snaring and aerial shooting of wolves and bears. And our U.S. Congress voted to overturn the Fish and Wildlife Service's protection and has just recently allowed those activities to happen on our national wildlife refuges in Alaska. It's a real tragedy.
Another disturbing element of what's happening in our political landscape. Yikes. All right, so that's, I think, probably brings us fairly smoothly, hopefully, into the Animal Legal Defense Fund, which is where you are now and have been for, I guess, 18 years or thereabouts. For folks listening who might not be familiar with it, maybe you could outline some key aspects of ALDF and the distinct niche it occupies among national organizations.
Sure. So the Animal Legal Defense Fund is the only organization that focuses exclusively on legal avenues of change. Our mission, as you said, to protect the lives and advance the interests of animals through the legal system really captures what we do. Protecting the lives of animals we're doing every day. We do that through working with prosecutors anywhere in the country in the handling of animal cruelty cases and doing trainings for prosecutors. And we file cases that have freed captive wildlife from horrific conditions or puppies from puppy mills, that sort of thing. And then advancing the interests of animals is kind of the other part of our effort, and that represents the legal work that we're doing to have animals recognized as more than just property. So essentially, the fundamental problem for animals in our society is that our laws still consider them things rather than living sentient beings, and that's a fundamental conundrum that makes protecting animals very, very difficult. So ALDF spends a lot of its time through our legal programs in figuring out ways that we can represent the interest of animals in court, in passing laws that better protect or give greater recognition to animals as more than just things. So our program work is divided up, by legal strategy. So we have a criminal justice program that is the one that works directly with prosecutors and law enforcement in the handling of animal cruelty cases anywhere in the country. We have our litigation program, which is where we file lawsuits and sue animal abusers or sometimes the government over lack of enforcement of laws. And we love to sue animal abusers. That's one of our favorite things to do. And then, we work on legislative campaigns, and we work with legislators, and we work with groups anywhere in the country to help write and pass stronger animal protection laws. And finally, we have programs devoted to getting law students and attorneys involved in our work. And so for law students, we developed a network. This was a program that I started shortly after I began working at ALDS back in 1999 that organizes and helps students to organize chapters of ALDS at law schools across the country. And that's grown tremendously. The first year I started that program, we wound up with about a dozen chapters, most that had formed just organically by students passionate about the issues. And we've grown to have about 215 student chapters now, not only in the U.S., but a few even internationally now. So very, very excited about that development. And that's a real statement on, you know, the level of interest in animal law and animal protection issues, you know, by people who are drawn to the law as a career and a life path. And as you mentioned, I'll be speaking at Stetson this Friday, and I'm also speaking next week at Florida A&M University in Orlando and Florida International University as well. On a couple of topics, and all of those are hosted by our student chapters, which is very exciting.
That is.
And then for any attorneys out there listening that want to get involved, we also have our pro bono program, and that's where we invite attorneys in practice or firms to sign up and help us directly by doing pro bono work for us, and we're excited that we've developed that network to include I think we're upwards of 400 law firms in the country have signed up with us, and nearly 2,000 individual attorneys have signed up. And collectively, last year alone, they did more than $3.5 million worth of donated legal work for ALDS. So really, just really helping us do a lot more legal work than we could possibly do on our own. So,
for sure.
It's exciting. It's exciting. There's a lot of growth and excitement about this field of law, and I really believe it's where a lot of the great advances in animal protection are going to come.
For sure. Well, in talking about the pro bono network and the amount of legal work that various attorneys and law firms did on behalf of ALDF, reminds me that when I was preparing for this interview, one thing that gave me pause was the name of the place is Animal Legal Defense Fund. It was founded by attorneys. Its signature distinction, as you've already kind of mentioned, among animal protection organizations, is using the legal system to offer those protections and remedies. Yet, if I have this right, when you began working for ALDF, there was no litigation staff?
Well, actually, there was.
Oh, okay.
We had had a litigation staff at one time in Washington, D.C., which was still around when I first started. But that office closed, and we decided to go a different route. So at the time, the organization had decided to outsource our litigation work. And one of my goals when I became the CEO in 2006 was to bring our litigation program back in-house, just as a matter of being far more cost-efficient and being able to grow and direct a team of lawyers in-house just seemed like a smart move. And I'm proud to say that our litigation team is just fantastic. We have so many bright lawyers who are doing good work for us, and we've had some incredible cases.
Well, no, that's great, and it does make perfect sense. And now I see that there was a little bit more of a evolution or sort of a circling back to the litigation staff. It just seemed very intriguing that, at least the way I had read it, that when you got there, there actually wasn't a litigation staff, but given what you do. But
right.
Now it sounds like there is in full swing, and then all the pro bono folks and others contributing. So now you have a mighty legal squad. So let's take a call or two here. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Stephen Wells from the Animal Legal Defense Fund.
Yeah, Stephen, thanks for the work work you do on behalf of the voiceless and the ones who can't defend themselves, would like to get your opinion on two different things. One is the animal personhood and animal sentience movement, which has a big impact on the legal standing of animals. Another is the Trump era. He's likely to stack the federal courts against us, and he has huge amounts of pro-animal cruelty, animal exploiters in his inner circle. So I'm sure that you have some great wisdom on both of those topics. Thanks for everything you do.
Thank you for your call.
Yeah, thanks very much. And let me address both those issues. So the movement for animal personhood, of course, attorney Steve Wise and the Non-Human Rights Project, which are based in Florida, are sort of front and center on that issues. And, you know, that's based on, it's one path. It's not the only path to gaining recognition of the legal interests of animals, which is also a goal of ALDF, as I mentioned earlier. Legal personhood is not a legal person is not necessarily people, not necessarily a human being. So famously, for example, you remember the controversy over corporations are people comments that Mitt Romney had made in a presidential campaign. What's actually true is that corporations are one example of something that is considered a legal person and is not, in fact, a human being. And so what personhood does is it grants some specific rights or recognition within the law that animals currently don't have. So that's certainly one way for conveying recognition of interest, the interest that animals do, in fact, have. And we know that. They are not things. That's an absurd notion and has to change. And that's one path to doing it. So it's great, and we're supportive of Steve Wise's work. He's got a couple of cases he filed on behalf of chimpanzees up in New York State, testing his legal theories in court for the first time. And whether or not he succeeds, it's a very, very, very long shot. The reality is that you know, his work has drawn a lot of attention to that fundamental problem in our law, and that's a good thing. And then secondly, the Trump administration, and yeah, this is as seems to be the case with virtually any issue in the country at the present time. You know, politics has invaded our lives in ways that we're just not used to in this country. And particularly, the Trump administration has caused a lot of people a concern, and we're asked about that a lot of times. And specifically, you know, the president, him or herself, generally, you know, doesn't do things directly impacting animals. But what's important is who the president appoints, and of course, the policies that they advocate, you know, the marching orders they give to those people. And there is certainly a lot of cause for concern with the appointments that President Trump has made to some of the agencies that do have a lot of impact over animals. And one notable thing is, of course, shortly after Trump took over the presidency, and the USDA then pulled information that it has kept traditionally on its website accessible to the public, and very important information about inspections and enforcement actions under the Federal Animal Welfare Act. And that information is important to groups like the Animal Legal Defense Fund and others that are interested in the welfare of animals and individual Americans as well. It's also information that was being relied on in several state laws that required accessing that information to check on puppy mills, to check on whether or not specific puppy mills had been in violation of the Animal Welfare Act. And that's important information that needs to be accessible. And it's a bad sign when a federal agency seems to take an action that has no real consequence other than to protect animal abusers. And that, in fact, is really the only argument one can make for doing that. So, you know, that's an example of the kind of concerns that we have. And, of course, we will address those concerns policy by policy, and in fact, we will be taking legal action to assure that those records are restored to the OCA's website and become accessible to the public again. And we'll stand ready. I mean, in how you deal with the change in administration is we buckle down and focus on our mission, and if we have to be spending more time in the defensive posture due to policies or activities of whatever political administration is in power, then that's exactly what we'll do. So the short answer is we'll keep doing more of the same, and we'll do our best to hold the line and make sure as we try and advance the laws and enforcement for animals that we don't allow any backsliding.
The words of a few minutes ago that you uttered are echoing in my ear, which is that we love to sue animal abusers, and sadly there may well be additional opportunities with the way things seem to be looking at the moment. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Stephen Wells, the Executive Director of the Animal Legal Defense Fund. He'll be in town Friday at Stetson University College of Law, participating in a panel discussion entitled Careers in Animal Law. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663. Fortunately, at the moment, it's been a little bit of a glitchy day at the station, so we can't access email or text, and the signal has been periodically dropping a little bit. I think it's been better in recent moments, but again, the stream is totally fine. The sound is totally fine if you want to stream online or by the WMNF phone app. So, Stephen, let's talk about Animal Legal Defense Fund, some recent efforts and victories, which may roll into some current things that are pending of note. Orcas are near and dear to many people's hearts, including my own, and therefore often an important topic on this show. Maybe you could talk a little about the California Orca Protection Act.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So the California Orca Protection Act was passed in California, I can't remember when, but within the last several months, and we were supportive of that bill. It was an organization called the Animal Welfare Institute that worked to get it introduced, and essentially it enshrines in California law some of the things that SeaWorld as a corporation under great pressure from animal advocates had decided to do. So it will prevent the breeding or import of additional orcas into California. So it essentially is a bill that is, inking the end of the captive orca industry in California. And so we're very, very excited about that. Interestingly, given that you're based out of Florida,
yeah.
We are currently working, ALDF is currently working to secure the introduction of a bill essentially that would do the exact same thing as the California Orca Protection Act in Florida. Mm-hmm. And at this, we're quite confident we're going to be able to get language introduced, and there may be news on that possibly as early as next week. So fingers crossed, and of course to all your listeners in Florida, we hope that they'll stay tuned and sign up hopefully to get alerts from us at ALDF.org, email alerts, so you'll know when to take action if and when that bill is introduced. And we're pretty excited about that. I was segueing into Miami Seaquarium.
Yeah, with Lolita. I was just going to say, before you do maybe, or I was going to ask really, to what extent does having the California Orca Protection Act pass and be in place now bode well, or make it almost maybe not a sure thing, but more likely that the Florida Orca Protection Act, or are there just enough different variables that even with what looks like to a layperson a bit of precedent, does it not necessarily work that way when it comes to introducing the same kind of legislation in a different state like Florida?
Yeah, great question. It doesn't work the same as actual legal precedent, which is set, by winning or losing cases in court. And I won't get in the weeds about that kind of legal precedent, but it certainly sets a general precedent. And there's sort of an adage that is often true that lawmakers often don't want to be the first do something. And it's a lot, it's easier to convince lawmakers, for good reason, pass a law or take some kind of action when, that course has been charted before by others, because there's already a track record and one can look at, any potential pitfalls and consequences. So, I certainly hope that California's passage of the Orca Protection Act will influence Florida as well. You know, there are similar concerns, and I think most importantly, what we've just seen a sweeping shift in public opinion on the idea of keeping these magnificent captive wildlife in conditions that don't allow them to exhibit any of their natural instincts or behaviors, and then worse, coercing them sometimes through means that are quite cruel to do performances, and so that's something that I think the public has spoken loudly about, and we saw the effects with SeaWorld ending its captive orca shows and not pledging not to bring any more orcas to their parks. And of course, famously with Ringling, first giving up its elephants and now shutting down entirely. People are viewing, forcing animals to perform for entertainment, very differently than we used to. And I think that's a great evolution in people's understandings of the needs of these animals.
Well, unfortunately, that interrupted you before. That does bring us to what may represent, for the moment at least, the flip side, which is Lolita and the Miami Sea Aquarium. Maybe you could talk a little bit about Lolita and ALDF's efforts in that regard.
Sure. So we currently have two legal cases pending aimed at Lolita's plight. And just to be quick for folks that don't know, Lolita is an orca kept at a place called the Miami Sea Aquarium. And she lives in the world's smallest orca tank, and a tank that actually violates the USDA's already shamefully deficient regulations on the size that an orca tank has to be legal. So we have filed, along with several other groups, including PETA, a case under the Endangered Species Act, which prohibits any conduct that risks gravely harming an animal that is listed under the Endangered Species Act. And that case is currently on appeal before the 11th Circuit. We have fully briefed the appellate court and are awaiting a date from the court for oral argument, where lawyers will actually go in and argue before the judge. So that's pending. And the second challenge is a case we filed against the USDA, and the Miami Sea Aquarium was purchased by another company, and the USDA basically allowed them to continue operation under the existing permit, and our claim is that was illegal, and that the USDA has to, given the change in ownership, reassess the entirety of Lolita's condition, including her enclosure, and assure that it complies with the Animal Welfare Act, which it does not. And so we're suing the USDA over allowing that permit to continue. And that case is pending. The USDA and the new parent company, Miami Sea Aquarium, have filed a motion to dismiss. They're trying to kick us out of court. That issue is pending before the court right now.
Okay. Well, we're unfortunately hurtling towards the end of our time, but I want to get at least one more caller involved. This caller's been waiting for quite a long stretch. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Stephen Wells from the Animal Legal Defense Fund.
Hi. I just lost this email I was going to read to you from. I actually called Senator Nelson about this issue because there was a friend of mine sent me an article. Oh, here it is. I just got it. Let me just pull it up again. It says a bill is headed to President Donald Trump's desk that would overturn Obama-era hunting restrictions protecting grizzly bears and wolves and other animals on national wildlife refuges in Alaska from hunting tactics such as aerial shooting, baiting, and killing animals at their dens or with their cubs. The Senate approved the bill to repeal the hunting restrictions on Alaska's 16 federal wildlife refuges on Tuesday on a vote largely split on party lines that pitted the issue of states' rights and wildlife conservation. The bill was approved by a vote of 52-47. So this is already going to Trump's desk to be signed. Is there any, you know, I think this is unspeakably cruel, you know, to kill bears and wolves in their dens. It said something about they can even kill hibernating bears. I just don't understand how people can be so cruel. But at this stage, is there anything that you all can do about that?
All right. Thank you very much for your question and your call. Steve?
Yeah, that was the bill I mentioned earlier when we were talking about a sort of a tail end of talking about Alaska. And sadly, that's passed. That is going to override the protections for wolves and bears that had been established by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on national wildlife refuges. And as the caller mentioned, that bill was approved on a straight party line vote. So all the Republicans voted for that bill, and the Democrats voted against it. And given that the Republicans are currently in the majority, that bill passed. And so what it does is it basically hands over management of wildlife on national wildlife refuges back to the states on those issues that have been covered by Fish and Wildlife Service regulations to protect wolves and bears. And it's a tragedy, really. It's an absolute tragedy that this became a priority. The Fish and Wildlife Service, of course, is the agency of the federal government that is tasked with and has the professionals and biologists to create these regulations, and they did not issue those protections on National Wildlife Refuge for no reason. There are really good biological reasons why those wolves and bears should be protected in those ways, especially from those horrific forms of hunting. So it was a really sad day when we saw politics supersede common sense and biological wisdom and overturn regulations that would have protected wolves and bears. So we will certainly be looking at all options as those regulations are rescinded, and we look at what the consequences are. But sadly, at the moment, Congress has the power to do that, and they had the vote to get that bill passed.
So, Steve, we're desperately short on time. I just want to try to shoehorn in a couple of quick things. One is, I guess now, rather than a question or a conversation, I guess a comment about a recent piece in the New York Times that in some ways connects back to some things you mentioned about some of the law, and when you also were addressing our first caller about Stephen Wise and the non-human rights folks. But this was a piece about when couples divorce and who gets to keep the dog or the cat. A colleague of yours, Jeff Pierce, was quoted in the piece. But it gets into a very interesting thing about the whole concept of animals as property, and then in some cases not viewed that way, and how that complicates matters like this.
Yeah, that's right. It's a very exciting thing. You know, the Animal Legal Defense Fund has, for many, many years, offered our expertise in legal battles that involve custody of an animal. And so in real simple terms, given that our laws, as I mentioned earlier, consider animals as your property, in other words, things, you know, ownership, quote unquote, of these things, like any other item, like a desk or a chair or a couch, is considered by the court typically strictly on the issue of who can claim greater ownership, you know, who directly paid some of the bills, or who originally, you know, say purchased the animal or paid the shelter fees to bring the animal in. But unlike all those other forms of property that I mentioned, is that we know animals are living sentient beings and have interests of their own about where they wind up living. And so we have made the argument for years through filing amicus briefs, which are our friend of the court's briefs, as a neutral party to custody cases, arguing that the court should consider not just the ownership interests of the two parties involved, but also the interests of the animal involved, and make an effort to ascertain where the animal would be better off in the custody case. And some judges have been willing to do that. There's an interesting phenomenon in divorce cases, which is where this issue commonly comes up, where some lawyers have decided the matter based on what they call calling contests. And they literally will have the parties to the case sort of at opposite ends of a room and calling to a dog involved and seeing which direction the dog goes. So it gives you an idea of the complications of this, and at least is an effort to determine to give the animal some form of choice. Now those are not legally binding, unless both parties stipulate. But the new thing in the subject of the New York Times article is a move to enshrine in law that courts must consider the interests of the animals. And a law was passed in Alaska, previous Alaskan, I'm proud to say, that does just that. And that's a good thing. That is a sign that our courts and our legal system, you know, any recognition, which is long overdue, as we can all agree, common sense wise, for our courts to recognize that animals are not simply property, they're not simply things.
Yeah,
a good thing, and recognizing that they have interests in their own lives and well being that should be recognized and respected by our laws is positive development.
Right. Okay, well, gosh, we are not only out of time, we're over time. So there's other things I was hoping to get to, including ag-gag laws and a new one in Arkansas, and, of course, bear hunts in various states, including Florida. But I'm just going to recommend people go to aldf.org and find out all kind of information or sign up for alerts. And meanwhile, Steve will be in town Friday speaking on a panel called Careers in Animal Law at Stetson University College of Law. So this has been Stephen Wells from Animal Legal Defense Fund. Stephen, thanks so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animal.
Thank you for having me.
In a few moments, I'll talk with Greyhound correspondent Don Goldstein about some new legislation pending for Greyhounds. Right now, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner with Eddie Izzard, with a piece whose title resembles the name of this show. This is Talk to the Animals from Eddie Izzard in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
But, you know, whales, they're intelligent. They do whale song. We don't know what it means, but I think that whales are traveling at 78. They're traveling at 78 speed, and if we take them up to 45 speed, we'll find they're actually going, I love you, baby. And if it's quite all right, I love you, baby. Well, then I love you, baby. Yeah, they're DJs, you see. DJs of the sea. Because sound travels well in water, and they need a big PA to be a DJ, but they've got their whole bodies. Yeah, it works, doesn't it? This next song is going out to all the goldfish down by the Azores. I love you, baby. So they're intelligent, and dolphins, they're intelligent because we all saw the documentary Flipper. Well, dolphins came up going, what's that? What's that, Flip? Chiang Kai-shek is having trouble. Mao Zedong has taken over mainland China. Chiang Kai-shek has retired to Taiwan with some of his followers, where they will have a complete disregard for international copyright rules. Is that what you're saying, Flip, or do you want fish?
That was Eddie Izzard with a portion of a piece called Talk to the Animals, taken from his album Circle. Now on to my conversation with Don Goldstein about some new Greyhound legislation that's being considered. Let's welcome Don Goldstein back to Talk Animals. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you today?
I'm really well. How about yourself?
Doing wonderful.
Great. Well, again, it's always a pleasure to have you on because you're not only a longtime Greyhound guy, but you're in the thick of things usually when there's legislation afoot. So fill us in on what's happening in that front at the moment.
Well, we're kind of excited this year. We've got a couple of bills in each house that affect Greyhounds or will affect Greyhounds in the future. One of them in the House is called House Bill 743, and the companion bill in the Senate is Senate Bill 512. These bills would ban the use of steroids, anabolic steroids, in greyhounds. And these steroids, principally testosterone, are basically used to keep the females from going into season during their racing career. They do that just because they don't want to lose racing days, essentially. When a female goes into season, obviously they can't have them racing against the males because, of course, greyhounds are not either spayed or neutered during their racing career. They're unaltered. So they can't have the females in season while they're racing, so they would lose anywhere from 6 to 8 racing days during that, and that would happen most often twice a year. They don't want to do that, so they give them anabolic steroids or testosterone to keep them coming into season. It has the potential to cause some issues. My wife and I, over the 25 years we've been rescuing, we've had 6 females. We've adopted 6 females, and of those 6, 3 of them have showed physical attributes attributable to extensive steroid use. So
what does that look like, Don? I mean, how does that manifest itself?
In all 3 of ours, one was a pseudohermaphrodite, meaning she was starting to develop male characteristics, mm-hmm. Genitalia characteristics, yeah. And the other 2 had deformed genitalia.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yikes.
In all of our cases, all 3 of ours, it never really affected their health. We got them all pretty young, so it was not an extensive thing.
Yeah.
But we hear stories about other issues. And it's unnecessary. There's just other ways to do this. All they have to do is keep them isolated. And yes, they will lose the racing days, but they just have to keep them isolated from the males during that time.
And
so we're excited about that. Senator Danny Young and Representative Guillermo Smith from Orlando are the 2 principal sponsors of those bills. We thank them very much for their interest in that and furthering the health of greyhounds.
And what is the timetable, and what can people listening who care about greyhounds or more generally, hopefully, about animals do to help with this?
Representative Smith's bill is actually going to the floor. I'm not sure exactly when it's going to hit the floor, but it has passed through all of their committees. Senator Danny Young's bill, companion bill on the Senate side, is still in committee. If they watch for that bill, and if you can go to myfloridahouse.org or floridasenate.org and do a search on those bills, you can actually track them. That's SB 512 on the Senate side and HB 743 on the House side.
Okay, great. And then I think there's one other bill that we were going to talk about.
Right, that's the general gaming bill. It's Senator Bill Galvano's bill. His attempt is to consolidate all of the gaming regulations. This is something they've been trying the last several sessions without notable success. Senator Galvano's bill has gone further than any other so far. In fact, it's coming to the floor today on the Senate side. It does contain a small provision within the bill, and it's exciting for us, and it's something that we've been working on. We have access for quite some time. We call it decoupling. For your listeners who don't know the way Florida law works right now, is in order to maintain the card room, the poker licenses at horse races, dog races, and high life frontons, they have to run live races. They have to have the 90% of the same number of races they had in 1996. So what we've got is a bunch of dogs that are being forced to race. Nobody's watching them. Nobody's betting on them. But the track owners have to continue these races in order to maintain their card license, which is very profitable. The dog racing is not. To the tune of somewhere between $2 and $4 million that the state is supporting dog racing. That's the difference between what they bring in their licenses and fees and taxes, and what it costs them to actually regulate the industry.
And I know we've talked about this many a time. I still cannot seem to grasp, maybe it's just my own intellectual shortcoming, but why that cannot be decoupled, why there isn't some way to say, look, here's what you do, here's how you make your dough, why insist on having dog races for no particular reason other than that seems to be you know, currently the regulation?
The dog racing industry has a very strong lobby. They are very resistant to change. Originally, when the two were coupled was in 1997. That's when card rooms were first allowed off of the reservation. And they used that as a method to limit the number of card licenses issued. They said it had to go into an existing pari-mutuel betting facility. And it did. It effectively limited the number of licenses, card licenses, they were going to issue. But it's run its course. It is outdated. It's been 21 years. And I mentioned this to a lot of the legislators up in Tallahassee. I asked them, can you point to another instance where the state of Florida requires a business owner to lose money in one business model in order to make money in another business model? And, of course, they can't point to anything like that where the state is requiring it. So.
Not to mention the separate but somewhat parallel embarrassment that Florida, with all these states that over the years have stopped dog racing altogether, that Florida is still hanging tough.
Right. We can't explain it, but again, decoupling is in Senator Galvano's bill, which we're very happy to see. Fortunately, on the House side, in their version of the gaming bill, there is a specific provision which would require greyhound racing to continue for 20 more years. Inexplicable. I'm sorry. I can't understand that. It makes to me. There's only 6 racing states left in the United States. There's only 19 tracks active in the United States in those 6 states. But of those 19 dog racing tracks, 12 of them are in the state of Florida.
A blight. Don, I'm afraid we're out of time and got to go, but thank you for filling us in on this, and we'll keep a close eye on those bills and hope that some sensible legislation does indeed pass all the way through. Thank you so much.
Super. As always, thank you very much, Duncan, for your support.
Thank you. This is the tail end of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. NPR News is next.